Dear Sam, Lucy had her pingo what's it today. She wanted me to go with her, but for heaven's sake, I have a job. The BBC pays me to sit twiddling my fingers at Broadcasting House, not at Spannerfield Hospital, besides which, today I actually had something to do, believe it or not. The Prince's Trust are putting on a big concert in Manchester. Radio 1 is going to broadcast it live, and the whole concert has been designated a light entertainment brief, i.e. my responsibility. There are two reasons for this. Firstly, there will be comedians on the bill, comedy, of course, being the new rock and roll, like hell. Secondly, the bill will mainly be made up of ageing old rockers, and nobody at Radio 1 who's into music wants to touch it with a barge pole. They all think that because some of the artists who are to perform have committed the cardinal sin of being over 40 and doing music that has tunes, the whole thing is terminally uncool and should be on Radio 2 anyway. So there we are. It turns out that it is to be me who's heading up the BBC Radio side of the operation, which is why today I found myself back in Quark in Soho, having lunch with Joe London. Yes, the Joe London. As in lead singer of the Mothers, a man who bestrode the late 60s and early 70s rock scene like a colossus. Well, they might sneer back at the office, all those shaven-headed boys wearing yellow sunglasses indoors and girls with little tattoos of dragons on their midriffs, but I was bloody excited to meet Joe London. This was my history. Joe was big when I was at school. I can remember him when he didn't have a courgette to put in his trousers. Bloody hell, that man couldn't half rock in the old days. "We're all absolutely delighted at Radio 1 that you can do this show for us, Joe," I said.
"Oh, yeah, tasty. Nice one. As it happens, no problem, geezer."
"And, of course, the Prince's Trust are very grateful, too."
"Diamond geezer. The Prince of fucking Wales. Lovely bloke. Know what I fucking mean? Likes his rock as Charlie. Big Supremes fan and so good with the boys."
Joe quaffed an alcohol-free lager.
"What's it in aid of, then, this concert?"
he said. "Well, Joe, principally helping young kids with drug abuse." Suddenly Joe's amiable manner changed.
"Well, I think that is fucking disgusting, mate," he sneered. "Lazy little sod. When we was young, we had to go out and get our fucking drugs ourselves."
I was just clearing up this misunderstanding and explaining that the point of the show was to help underprivileged youth when we were joined by Joe's manager, a huge, spherical man with a cropped head and a cropped beard, and no neck. His head just seemed to develop out of his shoulders, like the top of an egg. He wore a black silk Nehru suit and silver slippers, and he was bedecked in what must have been 2 or 3 kilos worth of gold jewellery. His name was Woody Monk, and he greeted me with a nod before turning to whistle with approval at our waitress, whose skirt was even shorter than on the last occasion I'd seen it. I imagine it had shrunk before the gaze of 1,000 middle-aged media leerers who stared at it each lunchtime.
"I remember this place in the 60s, when it was a knocking shop," said Woody Monk. "The birds working here didn't look much different, actually."
I really was dining with the old school. Joe and Woody were rock and roll as it used to be. And it made me feel like a kid again. These days, most pop managers look like Tintin with sunglasses. I asked Woody Monk if it might be too much to hope that Joe would do some interviews to promote the show.
"He'll do as many as you like. We need the profile,"
Monk replied, and then, as if to quell any protests that Joe might have, he showed Joe a copy of The Sun, featuring an article about the current Rolling Stones tour.
"Look at that, Joe," Monk said. "Just look at it. I mean, it's obscene, disgusting. This is just a totally ridiculous figure, out of all proportion."
Joe took off his sunglasses and had a look.
"I don't know, Woody. I like a bit of silicone myself."
Monk tried to be patient.
"I'm not talking about the Berger Divi. I'm talking about this new Stones tour. 100 million, they reckon. And the Eagles got the same. It's the arenas and the stadiums."
Monk explained to me.
Megabucks. These places gross in humongous proportions. In the old days when people talked about gross on ore, they meant waking up with a mouthful of sick and a strange rush on your noughties. But nobody tours for the shagging anymore. They do it for the gelt. Every gig is worth millions of dollars. Can't stop for a bit of the other. Accountant won't let you.
Basically, Monk's point was that Joe needed to tour again in the near future. His latest, greatest hits album would be out for Christmas, and it needed supporting.
Are we releasing another greatest hits album, then? Said Joe.
Yeah, but a prestige one. Nice, classy cover, all in gold. The Gold Collection.
We done the Gold Collection.
All right, the Ultimate Collection.
Done that too. And a Definitive Collection. And the Classic and the Unforgettable.
Look, Joe, Monk snapped.
I could see that he was a volatile chap.
We'll call it the same old crap in a different cover collection if you like. It don't matter. What we've got here is the Prince of Wales flogging your comeback.
There. It was out, and Woody Monk did not care who knew it. As far as he was concerned, this concert was a marketing exercise for Joe London, and that was it. I didn't mind. It meant Joe would promote it for us, which was more than any of the modern stars would do these days.
I'm not doing any fucking press, all right?
Joe, however, seemed a little embarrassed, though not, as it turned out, about the charity angle.
This ain't a fucking comeback. To have a comeback, you have to have been away, and I have not been, so this is not a fucking comeback.
All right, said Monk. It's a fucking Still Here tour, then.
That's right.
You can go on stage and everyone can shout, fuck me, are you still here, then?
I honestly cannot remember when I have had a funnier lunch, and to think I wasted all those years lunching with comedians.
Anyway, I got to go, said Monk, turning to me. We're all sorted, aren't we?
I said that as far as I knew, we were extremely sorted.
Good, because we don't want no fuck-ups. This gig is very important.
That's right, said Joe. What with the underprivileged kiddies and all that?
Bollocks to the underprivileged kids, said Monk,
hauling his massive bulk to his feet.
They should get a bloody job, bleeding scroungers. Fuck 'em.
So that was that. Anyway, enough of my day job. Time to get down to my script. Lucy is sitting opposite on the bed, looking lovely as she always does. She's very pleased with me at the moment because I seem to be doing so much writing. She thinks it's all for my book. I'll have to tell her soon because things are really progressing with the film. I've called it Inconceivable. And I've been in to see Nigel to admit that the writer is none other than my despised self. He was a bit taken aback at first, but then he laughed and was actually very nice about it. He congratulated me and said that sacking me was the best thing he ever did, and that when I picked up my Oscar, I was to remember to thank him. It's interesting. Ever since he commissioned my movie script, I've been warming to Nigel, and now consider him to be a thoroughly good bloke. Is that desperately shallow of me, or evidence of my generous and forgiving nature? Anyway, the very exciting news is that the BBC really want to get on with it. Nigel feels that the idea is very current and that everybody will be doing it soon. Besides which, the film will be extremely cheap to make, which means that the Beeb can pay for it all by themselves. The reason films usually take years to get together is because that's how long it takes to raise the money. But we're already past that hurdle, and Nigel is impatient to become a film producer. Movies work in a yearly cycle, he explained. The festival circuit is essential for a small picture. Venice, Sundance, Cannes. You need critical heat under you before the Golden Globes in February. He actually said critical heat under you. Strange. Whereas before I would have thought he sounded like a pretentious wanker, now I think he sounds knowledgeable and cool. The reason Nigel is in such a hurry is that the whole thing about being a controller at the BBC is that you have to make your mark. When you start looking for a fat job in the independent sector, you have to be able to say, it was in my time that we did the Generation Game, or, oh yes, I commissioned Edge of Darkness and Noel's House Party. These days, the scramble to be seen to be successful is becoming ever more urgent. People move on so quickly that you have to make your mark quickly too. And it seems that, thank you, God, I am to be the beneficiary of Nigel's haste.
Dear Penny, we went in to see Mr. Agnew today at Spannerfield. He gave us our test results and everything remains clear. Sam's sperm is fine, about 90 million of them, which is enough, surely, and a sufficient number of them heading in the right direction to pass muster. Also, my pingy thing seems to have come up normal. Mr. Agnew assured me that my tubes aren't scarred. Also, there are no adhesions, fibroids, adenomyosis or polyps in the womb, and that the area where the tubes join the uterus is similarly polyp-free. These polyps, it seems, are things to be avoided. I don't really know what a polyp is. I suppose I think of them as sort of small cysts. Actually, I try very hard not to think about them at all. Quite frankly, just hearing about the 8 million things that can go wrong inside a woman's reproductive system is enough to make me ill. All Sam has to worry about is whether his sperm can swim. Anyway, Mr. Agnew was very nice and agreed with me that since we have uncovered nothing operable or treatable and yet we remain stubbornly infertile, the time may now be right to commence a course of IVF. Mr. Agnew said that not only would this give us a chance of becoming pregnant, obviously, but it might also prove useful in a diagnostic sense, i.e., we might discover what, if anything, beyond the most incredible bad luck, is the problem. Fine, I said. When can we start? 7 months, said Mr. Agnew. Bollocks to that, I replied in so many words, and Mr. Agnew explained that if we go private, we can start next month. So that is what we'll do, and I don't care what Sam says. If I'm going to have to do this, I'll do it as soon as I possibly can, and start the long, horrible process of getting it over with. Quite apart from anything else, as far as I can see, the NHS is under such a strain that if we can afford to pay, we ought to do so, and not take the place of someone who can't. Sam says that that attitude simply reinforces the two-tier system. Well, what if it does? I have a home while other people are homeless. Isn't that a two-tier system? Should I go and sit in a doorway to avoid reinforcing it? I eat ready-prepared meals from Marks and Spencer while people in the third world struggle to grow a few grains of wheat. How many tiers are there in that system, I wonder? Anyway, it's not posh at all. We all get lumped in together, and all the profits that Spannerfield makes out of the private patients go straight back into the unit to fund the research program. Personally, I thought that us making a contribution to funding research sounded like a pretty good thing. But Sam says that NHS hospitals using private patients to fund their activities is the thin end of the privatisation wedge. He says that the people who manage the NHS budget will say to the hospitals, "Well, if you're partially self-funding already, we'll cut back on your allocation of public money and force you further into the marketplace." Hence the financial necessity of having a private system will become entrenched within the funding bureaucracy. At that point, I couldn't be bothered to argue any further and told him to give all his food and clothes to Oxfam if he felt that strongly about it, which he doesn't. Sam has just asked me whether hysterosalpingogram begins with an H-Y or H-I. He seems to have suddenly got very enthusiastic about doing his book and getting all the details right. I know I should be glad, and I am in a way. After all, it was me that made him start it in the first place. It's just that I wish he'd share some of those thoughts and feelings with me. The way we talk to each other and react to each other has become just a little bit mechanical and predictable. Is that what happens in a marriage? Is it inevitable? I'd love to talk to Sam about that sort of thing, but I know he'd just try and change the subject. Oh, well, at least now he's writing down his feelings, which I'm sure is the first step towards him being able to share them. I'm trying not to think too much about wanting a baby at the moment. I find it drains me. I wake up feeling all fine, and then I remember that according to my life plan, I ought to have a couple of 5-year-olds rushing to jump into bed with me. That's when a great wave of depression sort of descends, which I then have to fight my way out of by reminding myself how incredibly lucky I am in so many ways. Sometimes it works.
Dear Self, long meeting with George and Trevor at Television Centre today. Nigel was there for the first hour, but then had to rush off to Heathrow. 2 days seminar in Toronto. Children's TV. Did Bugs Bunny win? Cartoons and our children's mental health. Inconceivable is moving at a hell of a speed now. They're already talking about casting and a director, which is quite unprecedented. They do have some problems with the script, though. Nothing major. But it's something I'm going to have to think about very hard. It came up after we'd all been laughing at the communal masturbation in West London scene. We'd been improvising some gags about Colin sneaking a funnel in because those pots are far too small, and of course ejaculation is scarcely an exact science. Then George brought up what was worrying them. It's too blokey, mate. Colin's stuff is really good, hilarious in fact. And touching in a strange sort of way, Trevor added. But Rachel is a worry, George went on. Frankly, she's a bit two-dimensional. I couldn't deny that I'd been worrying about her myself, and was pleased to have the chance to discuss it. We all agreed that she has some good lines, but George and Trevor and the 90 other BBC bods who seemed to have read the thing felt that she was clearly being drawn from a male point of view. There's no real heart there, said Trevor, and let's face it, essentially, this has to be a woman's story. You can't base a movie about infertility simply on a load of knob and wank gags. Excellent though they may be, George added. You have to get inside the character of the female lead. Maybe you should take on a woman co-writer. I can't even bear to write down the terrible thought that leapt immediately into my mind when Trevor said that. This will need careful consideration.
Dear Penny, the die is cast. I'm booked in to start after my next period, presuming, that is, and I must at all times remain positive. A miracle hasn't happened naturally. Oh, God, I do so want a child. Sometimes I think about praying. Not like going to church praying, but just at home in the quiet. In fact, if I'm honest, I do occasionally offer up a silent one, just in my head when no one's about. But then I think that that's wrong and presumptuous of me because I don't believe in God in any conventional sense, so I have no right to pray to him, her, it. Do I? On the other hand, if he doesn't exist, I've lost nothing. And if he does exist, then I imagine he'd prefer even a sceptical prayer to no prayer at all, so I can't really lose, can I? I'm certainly not an atheist anyway, because there must be something bigger than us. There are so many questions that scientists can't answer. Who are we? Who made us? Is there a reason? The easy answer to all that, of course, is God. The universe is a mystery, and we shall call the author of that mystery God. That's how I see it, anyway. I suppose I'm an agnostic, which I know is the easy way out. And also very self-indulgent, because basically it means not believing in something except when it suits you. Actually, I think it's amazing how arrogant we've become about God. He used to be a figure of fear and majesty, the ultimate authority before whom humanity was supposed to prostrate itself in humble repentance for our sins. Now you hear people talk about God as if he was some kind of rather eager stress counsellor or therapist. I was watching a bit of daytime American chat show the other day, and someone said, I hadn't talked to God in a long time, but when I needed him, he was there for me. The presenter nodded wisely and added, You have to make time to let God into your life. This unbelievable banality actually got a round of applause. I couldn't believe the arrogance of it. Like this person and God were equals, pals. It's amazing. This ready appropriation of the supreme being as some sort of spineless yes-man who is on ready call to tell you that you're beautiful and that everything is fine whenever you feel a bit low. I can just imagine God sitting in his heaven amongst his mighty host thinking to himself, Oh, no, some self-indulgent, self-obsessed and sack of decaf and doughnuts hasn't called. If only these people would make room in their lives to let me in. I really don't know what I feel about religion. But I do know that if I'm going to have a god, I want a great and terrible god, a god of splendour, mystery and majesty, not one that spends his time chatting to whingers about how stressed they are. Perhaps I'm just being mean. If people find comfort that way, why should it worry me? I wish I could find comfort, just a little, because I do want a baby so very much, and sometimes the feelings are so strong, I don't know what to do with them.
Dear Sam, Lucy got her period today. We've drained the dregs at the Last Chance Saloon, and now it's time to put our trust in the medical profession. Lucy asked me if I'd thought about praying, and I said I hadn't, but I was happy to give it a go. She wanted me to. We must leave no avenue of opportunity unexplored. Who knows, it might work. It seems to me that the idea of an old man with a white beard sitting on a cloud dispensing goodwill doesn't sound any more absurd than the bollocks most physicists talk. I mean, really, every single bloke I know bought A Brief History of Time, and not one of them, including me, understood a single word of it. Why do we have such faith in scientists? When I was at school, they told us that in days gone by, simple folk believed the world was balanced on the back of a tortoise. Oh, how we laughed. What a bunch of prats, we said, ho, ho, ho. Because we know better, don't we? Apparently, according to Stephen Hawking and his pals, there was this tiny lump of infinitely dense stuff the size of a cricket ball, contained within which was the entire universe. Where this cricket ball was and where it had come from are questions which apparently only stupid people ask. Anyway, one day the rock exploded, and all the energy and stuff blasted out from the epicenter and formed into stars and galaxies, which are still hurtling outwards to this very day. Now, why is that any more convincing than the tortoise? They keep saying that if we spend another trillion or two on a new telescope, they'll be able to tell us exactly how the universe began. They keep telling us how close they are, saying things like, when the universe was 3 seconds old, protons began to form. Well, maybe, but I think that 100 years from now, they'll discover that the universe got farted out the arse of a giant space elephant, and school kids will all be laughing to think that anybody ever believed in the Big Bang Theory. Sometimes the self-righteousness of the scientific profession really gets on my nerves. They always seem to assume that science is sort of outside society, that what scientists do is pure, and that it is other people who corrupt it. I saw a documentary about Einstein and Oppenheimer on the Discovery Channel the other day, and it was going on about what simple, peaceful men they were, and that during the war they sent a letter to President Truman pleading with him not to drop the bomb. They said that it was too big, too terrible, and man had no right to unleash such a force. All I could think was, what a couple of hypocrites. For years they'd struggled. For years they'd devoted their colossal brains to developing a bomb, which the rest of us would have to spend our lives living in the shadow of. And then they reckon they can get out of their responsibilities by saying, please don't drop it, and go down in history as sad-eyed, white-haired old peacemakers. I went in to see Nigel today. He'd rung me twice from Toronto, sounding me out about directors and co-producers. He feels we need to bring some experienced filmmaking talent into the mix. He's right, I think. I mean, George and Trevor are great, but what do they or I know about doing a distribution deal with a chain of movie houses in France? Besides which, Nigel feels that the budget will need to expand somewhat and put it outside the reach of the BBC alone. The reason for this is not because the film has got any more expensive, but because Nigel feels it has such potential that we need to take it to a name director, someone with a proven track record. That, of course, means paying the going rate, which can run into a great deal of cash. It's a fact that with most movies, particularly the Hollywood variety, a very large chunk of the vast budgets that are quoted so gloatingly in the press is actually spent on the wages of just a few individuals. Anyway, as I say, Nigel wants to make this movie in partnership with another production company. We need someone with experience, he said to me over the phone with the voices of Canadian TV execs crackling in the background. But hip, we must remember at all times that we are positioning ourselves at the cutting edge. I knew what was coming, and I wasn't wrong. Today I had my second meeting with Justin, Petra and Ewan Proclaimer from Above the Line Productions. I must say it was a very different affair this time. Petra actually smiled at me and Justin gripped my shoulder, saying,
"On the money, pal, kicking ass."
Even Ewan stopped snarling and treated me with a degree of civility. It seems that he's even hotter than he was when I met him at Claridge's. He's landed a 3-picture deal to direct in Hollywood. I doubt any of these films will be the AIDS and heroin project he showed me. In fact, he mentioned something about a sci-fi thing with Gary Oldham and Bruce Willis. Anyway, it seems he has a 6-month window before he begins pre-production across the big pond, and he loves my script.
"I love romantic comedy," he explained. "I've always liked romantic comedy, but not shite romantic comedy. I like romantic comedy with edge, with bite, with bollocks. To me, Macbeth is a romantic comedy, so's Oedipus. I mean, what could be more romantic than a man loving his ma so much he wants to shag her? And what could be more comical?"
Slightly worrying, but I let it go. After all, Ewan's name attached to the project certainly ups the ante all round. And of course, his timetable makes the whole thing even more urgent. Which is fine by me. Every film I've ever heard of seems to have spent years in the planning, and here I was, taking shortcut after shortcut. That brought us onto the script, with which there are still 2 problems, one little and one big. The little problem is that I haven't given the story an end yet. I say this is a little problem because I've actually worked out 2 endings that would work dramatically, one happy and one sad. I haven't been able to choose which one I want to go with yet. I suppose because Lucy and I are just starting IVF ourselves. I don't want to tempt fate. The bigger problem remains the woman's voice in the film. Everyone agrees that I haven't got it right yet, and that it's crucial. It's not a big thing. The story's fine, as are the jokes. It's just a matter of tone and emotional emphasis. I have to try and find a way to make the female perspective more convincing. I'm trying. I've been trying for days. But the more I try, the more Rachel turns into a bloke. Time's running out. Petra and Justin are setting up auditions. Ewan is scouting for locations. I must find the woman's voice.
"Dear Penny, picked up my first sackload of drugs from Spannerfield this morning. Me and a bunch of other women, all feeling a bit self-conscious. I have to sniff the first lot, which I'll begin tonight. You sort of shove a pump up your nose and give it a blast. It doesn't sound too difficult so far. Incidentally, although we'll be paying Spannerfield for the process, Dr. Cooper says that he'll pay for the drugs. Apparently, some local health authorities will fund fertility treatment and some won't. Ours will, which is very lucky, because the drugs cost literally hundreds of pounds. Life is such a lottery, it really is. Sam's going to Manchester for a night the day after tomorrow. It's this huge charity concert for the Prince's Trust he's involved with. The BBC are broadcasting it, and for some reason it's fallen to Sam to represent them. I could go, of course, and normally I'd love to, but I've told Sam that I'm still feeling a little under the weather after the pingogram, and I could really use a quiet week. This is a lie. My God, I can scarcely believe what I'm writing. But I've decided to see Carl. He rang me at work and asked me out to dinner, and I said yes. Of course, there's no reason for me to feel guilty or anything. I'm just going to have a bite to eat with a friend. I'm not going to do anything with him, obviously. But nonetheless, I can't say that my conscience isn't troubling me a bit. Because let's face it, I'm not going to tell Sam about it. Well, how can I? I can't say to him, 'Oh, by the way, while you're away, I'm going to have dinner with the dishiest man in England, whom, incidentally, I have already snogged.' Can I? Of course, I could say, 'Oh, I'm having dinner with a friend.' But then he'd say, 'What friend?' And I'd say, 'Oh, you don't know him.' And he'd say, 'Him?' And I'd say, 'Oh, for God's sake, Sam, it's not like that.' And he'd say, 'Like what?' And, oh, well, before we knew it, the green-eyed monster which doth mock the meat it feeds on would be knocking at the door, suitcase in hand, and planning a long stay."
Dear self, I'm writing this in my room at the Britannia Hotel, opposite Piccadilly bus station in Manchester, which is, I imagine, what Kremlin Palace must have looked like at the end of October 1917. Magnificent gilt, glittering crystal, carved marble, and hundreds of pissed-up yobbos wandering about looking for the bar and a shag. I love it. It's real rock and roll. Most of the BBC posse are staying at the Midland Plaza, which is a Holiday Inn but posher than most. However, Joe London and Woody Monk always stay at the Britannia.
"They understand a drinking man here," said Joe. "Not that I bother with all that now, but I like to remember. You know what I mean?"
"And a disco's always full of lovely fucking birds," Monk added.
On inspection, Monk was proved right about this. The disco was full of lovely fucking birds, but very, very tough-looking. Northern girls never cease to amaze me by how tough they look. I think it's the temperature. They seem to be impervious to cold. They never wear tights. It's amazing. In the middle of winter in Newcastle or Leeds, you'll see them making their way from bus station to club, groups of determined-looking girls in tiny mini-dresses, naked but for a square inch or two of lycra, bare arms folded against the howling wind, translucent white legs clicking along the sodden pavement in their impossibly precarious shoes. Never mind Scott of the Antarctic. These girls would have done it in half the time and got back before the chip shop closed. I must say I'm glad I'm married and past all that trying to pull birds business. I'd be far too terrified to talk to girls these days. Actually, I always was. Still, you can have a bit of a sad old look, can't you? And Monk, Joe and I have just celebrated the end of a great night by having a last drink in the Britannia Hotel Disco. And it has been a great night, I must say. A genuine rock extravaganza. Everything went brilliantly. Not like on Livin' Large. Believe it or not, my bloody sister rang and actually asked if I could take Kylie. I'm afraid the language I used was not very fraternal. I haven't sworn at her like that since we were teenagers. Kylie is such a little anarchist these days, she'd probably try to assassinate the prince. The show was at the Manchester Evening News Arena, which is just vast. There must have been 15,000 fans in there. Amazing. I had a doddle of a job myself, which was to... Well, quite frankly, I don't really know what my job was. Hanging around, I suppose, while the engineers did all the work. That's what executives do, isn't it? And eat lunch, of course. But it was far too late to eat lunch. We had an incredible bill. Representing the Wrinkleys was Joe London, Rod, obviously, and Bowie. We were to have had Phil Collins, but there was fog at JFK. Besides this, we actually had a pretty impressive turnout of current acts. Maybe the Prince is getting hip again. I certainly noticed that when the final bill was announced, some of my fashion junkie colleagues at BH looked quite miffed not to be involved. The biggest booking of the night was Mirage. They're colossal at the moment, and being from Salford, were almost local. The lead singer's name is Mankey, I think, and he hates absolutely everything, particularly, it seems, his own band. I went along to the sound check in the afternoon, and he was on stage having a fight with the principal songwriter in the band, an ugly-looking bastard called Bushy. What a show. All the mics were on, and this vast concrete arena was echoing to the sound of these two lads yelling abuse at each other and pushing each other around. "You fucking cunt! You can't fucking sing! You fucking cunt! You can't fucking write songs!" My heart sank because Mirage were the top of the bill, although Joe and Rod were pretending they were, and it didn't look as if Mankey and Bushy would survive until the evening. These boys may have been hooligans, but they were professional hooligans. One of the other members of the band started strumming his guitar.
"Look, are you fucking cunts just fucking about, or are we fucking sound fucking checking, you cunts?"
"Fuck it,"
said Mankey, turning to the mic, while Bushy picked out the familiar opening notes of Get Real, Mirage's current smash. I must say, Mankey can certainly sing. He has a wonderful sneer in his voice, which really does sound like he doesn't give a fucking fuck.
"Strawberry Lane and Penny Fields, Norwegian Walrus, yeah, yeah, yeah. Who's bigger than Christ now? I don't care.
Do you get my meaning with your psychedelic dreaming? I'm a somewhere man and will love to see the plan. Hey, Maisonette Bill, she's just a fool on the pill, cos getting on her knee is like having a cup of tea, or is it to get a real?
Some people detect a Beatles influence. When the song was over, Mankey snorted with contempt and burped hugely into the microphone. It was amazing. This colossal belch rang around the vast aircraft hangar, bouncing off the walls and the concrete floor. I thought it would bring the ceiling down.
"You disgusting cunt," said Bushy. "I'll eat your women knob, you sweaty twat."
After that, the whole band had a fight. As they left the stage, I could see two familiar figures approaching across the vast acreage of the venue. It was my old lunch buddies, Dog and Fish, who were to compare the night and provide the comedy element. From experience, I knew that basically this would involve them coming on between each act and pretending that they did not really want to be there. The strangest aspect of modern comparing, or perhaps I should say post-modern comparing, is that the host of the evening invariably seems to feel the necessity to dissociate himself from the proceedings, as if it was all some sad joke they're indulging in for a laugh. You see it at award ceremonies all the time. Some young blade comes on and basically says, "Look, we all know this is a pile of self-indulgent shit, and it's probably fixed, but welcome anyway." I think it's a shame. Bring back Michael Aspel, I say. But you see, my problem is that I like things to be nice.
"Hello, Sam," said Dog. "Shagged the missus that day, did you?"
For a moment, I was at a loss. But then I recalled the circumstances of my hasty retreat from 190. I didn't know what to say, so I laughed a bit, and left it at that.
"Yeah, sorry you got shafted out of telly," added Fish. "You were a straight geezer. Best thing that could have happened to you, though. Radio's the only truly postmodern no-bullshit medium. It's the new TV!"
"So my successor didn't give you a series, then?" I asked.
"No, bastard," Fish said morosely. "I couldn't believe it, even after we stormed it in Montreal and all the Yanks were queuing up."
Oh, well, it wasn't my problem anymore. I had this evening to worry about. "Now, you do know you can't swear, don't you?" I said.
"No fucking problem, Sam," said Dog,
and laughed as if this was a brilliant joke, and they headed for the stage. I could see why. Brenda was starting her sound check. Brenda is a singer, but her real claim to fame is that she is heart-stoppingly gorgeous. A regular star of the cover of Loaded magazine and a new lad icon. She usually performs in tiny see-through nighties and sings like she's having an orgasm. The number she was rehearsing is called "Sex Me Again, Sexy Baby." It's the follow-up to her big hit "Sex Me, Sex Me, Sex Me." Unfortunately, "Sex Me Again, Sexy Baby" seems to have flopped. And our sound engineer told me he'd read that she was going to have to do another Loaded magazine photo spread to revive her career, but that the editor had insisted that this time there was to be none of this coy stuff, and it would have to be nipples out. In our sad modern world, female pop stars have to be very successful indeed before it's allowable for them to perform with their clothes on. Brenda was not doing a proper sound check, because she was performing to a tape. But obviously a rehearsal was required so that the director of the concert video could ensure that Brenda's body would be well covered by the cameras, if by nothing else. Brenda's voice thundered out of the sound system as she strutted and pouted, miming the words.
"Sexuality, feel my physicality, baby, you and me, let's get it on. Sex, oh, sex, 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 my body is for you, do what you want to do. Use me and abuse me, caress me and undress me. Sex me, sexy baby, oh, deep inside, oh, oh, oh."
It was all a bit too much for me. More of that, and I'd have had to have a lie down. I wandered off to have a mooch around the hospitality section. I can't be standing about in vast empty arenas ogling young girls like that. It's not good for me. Besides, what would Lucy have thought? I always feel very close to her when I'm away. Absence making the heart grow fonder and all that. It made me a bit sad to think of her sitting at home, probably having a solitary bowl of soup or something, in front of EastEnders. I called her, but she sounded a bit distracted. She said she was tired and was going to put the answer phone on and go to bed really early.
Dear Penny, we met at Quark. I've never been there before, but I know Sam goes quite often on his numerous important lunches. It's very posh, and they give you little plates of nibbles the moment you arrive. I got there first, of course, and sat there feeling like an absolute slut. I mean, of course I hadn't actually done anything wrong, but it just seemed to me that everybody knew I was there for a clandestine dinner with a man who was not my husband. I knew the rash on my neck was coming up. No red wine, I told myself. In fact, no wine at all. My God, if I got pissed, there was no telling what would happen. The next thing I knew was that this dashing maitre d' was opening a bottle of champagne in front of me. Master Pheebs, as good to say he will be a little late, is said to give the lady champagne. Well, long story short, as they say, I'd had 2.5 glasses by the time Carl turned up. I didn't want to, but when one is just sitting there like a lemon, one does. Carl looked incredible. Everybody turned to stare. He's grown his hair and sideburns again, for a part of Dick Turpin, American cable movie. Silly script, but fun. And what with his dark curls and big coat, he looked as if he'd just come back from writing epic poetry and fighting duels in Tuscany. Anyway, he strode straight across to me, and without so much as saying hello or anything, he kissed me on the mouth. I mean, he didn't try to slip me the tongue or anything, but it was quite lippy and totally took me by surprise. Then he stood back, stared at me with his smouldering coal-black eyes, and said that I looked absolutely ravishing, which I did not. Although I must admit that I was wearing a new silk blouse with no bra. Silk does rather flatter the smaller bosom, like mine. Anyway, he was full of apologies about being late, rehearsals or something, and terribly important meetings. He said he already felt cheated because he knew that my husband was only away for the evening and that he'd already wasted 40 precious minutes of it. Well, that made me think, I must say. How did you know Sam was going to be away? I asked. Carl looked me in the eye. I'm ashamed to say that he wrote to me on behalf of His Royal Highness, asking me to read a poem at the Prince's Trust concert, and instead of agreeing, as naturally I normally would have done, well, it seemed like fate. I was amazed. He had waited until he knew my husband was out of town, and had then brazenly asked me out to dinner. "This is a planned seduction!" I exclaimed, and he continued to stare me in the eye and replied that he certainly hoped so. God, I must have been the colour of a shy beetroot. Carl, I'm married. I love my husband. You can't possibly be serious. I shouldn't even be here. Then why did you come? He asked. And I'm afraid to say he had me there. I mean, I could have protested that I had accepted his invitation entirely innocently. But after what had gone on before between us... Hardly. And me sitting there with my hair done and a breast-flattering new silk top on. The truth of the matter was that there was no way that this meeting could be innocent. I was just avoiding the truth because I was scared of it. Carl answered his own question. You're here because you're lonely, Lucy, because you need tenderness and passion and you're not getting it. I can see the longing in your eyes. I tried to protest that it wasn't true, but I'd lost the power of forming a coherent sentence, what with the champagne and the fact that in some ways... Oh, God, he was right! I've tried to do the honourable thing and keep away, as I said I would, Carl said, but when this chance came along, I couldn't fight it any longer. I've wanted you from the first day we met, Lucy. You fascinate me. I don't know any other woman like you. This couldn't be true, surely. I mean, Carl Phipps is a star, a heartthrob. He could have the pick of the bunch. I put this to him, but he insisted that I was different, that he really did want me above all others. Before I knew it, there we were, holding hands again. I really don't know if I encouraged this, but I do know that I had left my hand lying prone between us upon the table, and when he elegantly rested his hand upon it, I did not withdraw. Therefore, I suppose, I'm as guilty for what ensued as he.
The hospitality backstage was really buzzing. Charlie Stone was doing some interviews to be cut into the broadcast whenever any of the old rockers got into a particularly long guitar solo. I hung around with him and his recordist for a while, partly to let people know that I did have some status and also, let's face it, because he was interviewing absolutely gorgeous girls, including Brenda.
"So, Brenda," said Charlie, "what do you say to people who call you a sexist stereotype?"
Brenda drew herself up to her full height, which was about 5 feet nothing, and answered the charge.
"Well, I think they're the sexists because they don't understand that me being proud of my body and getting my kit off is actually all about being strong and female empowerment and the me I want me to be."
"Well, it certainly gives me the horn,"
Charlie said, getting to the point, so to speak. Brenda smiled a gorgeous smile, as if her point had been proved and honour satisfied. Next, I found myself in Joe London's dressing room. Woody Monk was there, of course, and Wally, the drug-addled lead guitarist of the Mothers and Joe's sidekick for nearly 30 years. Wally looked quite extraordinary, like a mummified corpse. He reminded me of that Stone Age hunter they found after he'd been frozen for 20,000 years in the Alps. Except Wally had a feathered haircut with a spiky top, which had only been preserved for about 30 years. They were rehearsing one of the Mothers' early hits, and Joe and Wally seemed to be having a little trouble remembering exactly how the song went. Joe said,
"Nah, man, you go fucking da-da-da-dum after the second line when I sing, 'Youngest gun, dream won't stop, what?'"
This threw Wally completely.
"Is that the lyric?"
he mumbled with apparent surprise.
"Of course it's a fucking lyric. I mean, we've only done it 8 trillion fucking times, geezer."
"Well, that's amazing, man," said Wally. "I always thought you were singing Currant Bun Cream on Top. Ain't that amazing?"
Then Joe saw me. It took a moment for him to focus, but he recognised me, which was nice, and he seemed genuinely pleased to see me. I told him how proud and happy the BBC were that he and the band had graced us with their presence, and he couldn't have been sweeter about it.
"I'll have a big gig, me. Nice big charity gig. Here, Wally, you remember that one we did for Rock Aid with Mark Knopfler and the Straits?"
"No,"
said Wally. Silly question, really, because it was quite obvious that Wally did not really remember anything at all.
"Mark done this guitar solo," Joe continued. "You know, the one in the middle of Sultans of Swing? Ba-ra-ra. Da, 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 da. It wouldn't stop. People was nodding off, going out for fags, getting married, having kids and dying. Mark's still giving it. Pack it in, you pots," we was all shouting, "but old Mark was off in a dabba-dabba-dabba land. In the end, we just left him to it. I think he's still going on somewhere as it happens."
Just then, Rod Stewart puts his head around the door to say hello. I must admit, it was all pretty exciting.
"Rod! How's it going, you old bastard?
What?"
Joe said. "Nice one, Asbury. Oh, sorry, Alana. How's Alana?"
This was, of course, something of a faux pas.
"Not Alana, you pillock," said Monk. "He moved on."
"Oh, yeah, sorry, how's Rachel?"
Joe corrected himself.
"I don't think it's her any more either," said Monk.
"Well, whatever then, the new one, how is she?"
Joe seemed impervious to social embarrassment.
"I saw that calendar she's done. Oh, lovely girl, beautiful."
"Very tasteful,"
Monk added.
"Yeah, that's right, it was tasty. Very tasty. That one with the sand stuck to her bum. That was well flipping artistic, that was. Yeah. See you, Rod. Keep rocking, mate."
Rod having gone on his way, Joe turned back to me.
"Lovely bloke, top geezer. Diamond. Hasn't changed at all. Still loves his soccer. That's what I like about gigs like this. They bring out the best in all of us. We're here to support starvation abroad and drug abuse at home. Just a bunch of top geezers and stunning birds coming together to help other people. No ego, no attitude. Just cats walk care."
At this point, Tony, Joe's supermodel wife, entered, all 7.5 feet of her. She had to stoop to get through the door. I recognised her from the pages of Hello. She seemed angry.
"Here, Joe," she said. "I've just been having a natter with him on Bowie." "Lovely girl," Joe interjected. "Stunning bird. She has been so good for David." "Yeah, well, they've got champagne in their dressing room, and what have we got? Bleeding Australian Chardonnay. What if Iman or Yasmin or any of the girls come in and offer them that? I'll be shamed."
Seeing how it was the BBC who were in effect hosting the event, and hence responsible for the catering, I made my excuses and left. The show was about to start anyway. I really wanted to ring Lucy to tell her about meeting Joe and Rod and Mirage and Brenda and about the whole fantastic show. But I knew she wanted a quiet night and was probably already in bed.
"Three bottles of wine between us. A quick, perhaps we should have coffee somewhere quieter. And suddenly I'm in a taxi heading for his place. Yes, we were snogging and, yes, now there were definitely tongues involved and, yes, he was using his hands, upstairs and outside only. But when all you're wearing is a silk blouse, quite frankly, it might as well have been inside. Before I knew it, we were in his flat. I know it sounds ridiculous to say before I knew it, but it really was. I mean, I have never done anything like this before, and it felt as if I wasn't really there, as if some other, more wicked self had escaped for the night. Carl was being wonderfully provocative. I mean, he didn't just leap or anything. He was, well, sensitive is the best way of putting it. After the initial pash in the taxi, he really held back, and I didn't feel at all pressurised. So how did I end up on the couch with him, with George Michael's Older on the CD and a 6-year-old brandy being ignored on the coffee table while we writhed together? Because I wanted to, that's why. The booze had knocked out my inhibitions, and I wanted to be there, with Carl breathing sensual nothings into my ear and expertly removing my shoes as if he'd been doing it all his life. And then suddenly, I'm floating through the air as he swept me up into his arms with hardly a jolt or a shudder and carried me through to his bedroom, beautifully neat, with a vast king-size bed covered in crisp, fresh white linen. This is a man who has a woman who does, no doubt about that. He laid me on the bed, and we kissed a little more, and then he began to unbutton my blouse. That was when I stopped it. I don't know how I did it, because I don't think I have ever felt so turned on, but I stopped it. His other hand was beginning to work its way up under my skirt, beautifully and gently, but under my skirt nonetheless. It was the absolute final point of no return. Somehow I managed to find a voice against every desire and hormone in my body. I asked him to stop. He did so, immediately. I mean, he was still half on top of me, but he suspended his exploratory hand actions, even going to the effort of doing up the button he had just undone. On the other hand, he did not remove his lips from my ear, into which he whispered, "Lucy, please, I want to make love to you all night, tenderly and gently and completely. I want to massage your body and touch every inch of your beautiful skin. I want to be part of you as one until the morning." Oh, God, I wanted it. How many years is it since Sam wanted to touch every inch of my skin? And massage? Christ, it takes me all evening to get Sam to give me even the most perfunctory shoulder rub, and here was this gorgeous man. Except all that has nothing to do with anything. I'm married, and I love my husband. And in the morning, what happens then? I asked. After all, a night of passion is a lovely thought, but I had a lot more to lose than he did. Then we'll make love again, and again in the afternoon, and then I'll ask you to stay another night, and another, and always. I love you, Lucy. I think I want you in my life. It's what he said. He's a man of strong and volatile passion, that's for sure. He really has got a thing for me. I swear he meant it too. He wants me to go and live in his flat with him. He thinks life should be lived on the impulse. Did I mention that he'd taken his shirt off? He did that after he'd laid me on the bed. He looked absolutely superb. More muscular than I'd expected, but not too much. I think saying no was the hardest thing I've ever done. Carl, I can't. You're wonderful, beautiful, and I could fall in love with you in an instant. Perhaps I already have. But I'm married. I love my husband. It's not exciting like this. But then nothing is exciting forever, is it? Isn't it? That's a rather bleak view to have of life, Lucy. And of course he was right. Oh, God, he was right. What an appalling thing to have to say. I want it, I crave it, I need it. But I'm going to deny myself because I believe that life is better lived sensibly and unexcitingly. Nonetheless, that is what I believe. You can't just go doing exactly what you like the whole time, not if you want to look after the things that really matter to you. Please, I have to go now, I said. I can't be strong for much longer. Will you call a cab, please? And, to his great credit, he did not try to persuade me further. He just said, of course, and rang for a taxi. I could see that he was as upset as I was. For some strange reason, he really has convinced himself that he's fond of me. Christ, I hated leaving that big, beautiful bed. This time, I really won't call you again, Lucy, Carl said as he kissed me goodbye, on the cheek. It wouldn't be fair on either of us.
The gig was pretty dreadful. I don't think I've ever heard anything so loud in my life. The engineers assured me that it sounded better on the radio, but it was rough going for the audience. I think all arena shows should be banned. They're utterly soulless. I don't care how good the act is. It could be Elvis come back from the dead. But if you have to watch it at 200 metres in what is basically a concrete aircraft hangar, it's going to be pretty dull. Anyway, the kids seemed to enjoy themselves, or at least they acted as though they did. And again, if you'd paid 20 quid, you're going to make the effort, aren't you? Afterwards, there was a line-up to meet the Prince, but I was excluded because the head of BBC Manchester had muscled his way in and nicked my place. I didn't really mind. I imagine you'd feel a bit of an idiot in one of those royal line-ups. I'm sure the royals do. Anyway, as I say, me and Joe and Woody Monk ended up in the bar at the Britannia. I managed not to drink too much, although I did have more than I meant to. Joe kept getting the rounds in. I've noticed that about people who've given up the booze. They're always very anxious to buy other people drinks. Vicarious pleasure, perhaps. Or else they just don't want you to think that they disapprove. Anyway, after Joe had got me my fifth bottle of pills, I had to explain that I was taking it easy, as I was likely to be called upon to provide sperm samples in the near future.
"Oh, blimey," he said. "Paternity suit, eh? I'll get one of those a week. Fucking DNA. Ruin the art of the casual shag."
"Well, I'm home now, drunk and feeling very strange. Angry with myself for so nearly doing something very stupid and angry with myself for not doing it. I know I'll feel terrible in the morning, even without the appalling hangover that I'm definitely due. But the main thing is that in the end I resisted temptation. Whatever I may have thought or desired, I did not actually do anything. Well, almost nothing anyway, and that's what matters. I know I let him feel my breasts, but I've decided to pretend even to myself that this hardly happened. Ditto tongue-sandwich-style kissing. Yes, I fully admit that I wanted him to shag my brains out for hours and hours, but we didn't, and I'm glad. One thing I do feel is that I'm very much in love with Sam. I hope that's not the booze and the guilt talking, because I do feel it. Perhaps not often, and not in the way Carl excited me tonight. But I do still fancy him. I mean it. It's not just because I'm drunk. He does still turn me on, and that's because I love him. And love is something to be cherished and protected. You can't go through life hopping from bed to bed. You can't just keep redoing the first few nights of a relationship, can you? Of course not. If you want love and the security that a proper relationship brings, then you have to go for the long haul. Even if you do really, really, really want to shag another bloke. Anyway, what I really want to say is that I feel very close to Sam now. I rang him at his hotel and told him so. I hope I didn't sound too drunk, because I have specifically asked him to cut down on the booze because of our IVF business, which I did not give a thought to tonight, like the disgusting slapper that I am. Also, I hope I didn't make him suspicious. I mean, I do sometimes ring up to tell him I love him. Well, it's not the first time. I'm far more effusive than he is. Oh, well. Actually, I think I'm going to be sick.
I just spoke to Lucy, which I'm really glad about. I'd just been thinking how much I missed her when she phoned. It was so nice. I haven't heard her as affectionate in ages. I suppose she was feeling the same way I was. It's not often we're apart. I really am a lucky man. A lucky, lucky man. I just don't deserve a girl like Lucy. She's beautiful and funny and interesting and I'm just a git. In fact, I'm worse than a git. I'm a bastard, a deceiving bastard, because I've already betrayed her trust over my movie script, and now I'm planning a second and even greater betrayal that I can hardly bear to think about, let alone write. I hope I didn't sound like I'd had a drink.